The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab.
Well, there's no other way to say it. Conductor Nicholas McGuigan is a superstar in the world of historically informed performances of Baroque music. He has the scholarly credentials and experience. He has passion for his subject, and he has a truly rare gift for bringing this music to life. What a special treat to be able to speak to you in person.
It's great to be here, my very first time in Cincinnati.
Ah, lovely. Well, you are here in town to conduct the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra and the May Festival Chorus in Handel's Messiah. And in fact, I understand you have really been traveling all over the world leading performances of Messiah.
I must have done close to 150 by now.
Wow.
I don't count, but it's an average of about 10 a year.
Wow.
And this will be 8, 9, and 10, in fact, this
wow.
for this year.
Wow.
And I've been doing it for over 20 years, so
Mm-mm.
so it must be at least that.
Mm. So how do you approach this work differently from performance to performance? I'm wondering whether you come in with an interpretive idea and then you try to sort of mold the group you're leading, or whether you adapt your approach depending on the forces that you're
working
with.
Well, it's a bit of both, to be perfectly honest. The orchestra parts, for example, are organized. The bowings, as organized as I can be. The dynamics and so on. Also, I send ahead to the chorus master, who's Robert Porco, he is, whom I have known for a long time, and who's terrific, as is the chorus, that I send a tape of a recent performance, so they know this is what I did last time, so they know approximately what's what. But then the soloists are different every time. The orchestra is different. The space in which you do it is different, not only in size. Sometimes it's a sacred space. Sometimes it's a very big space, as here. Although I was in the Royal Albert Hall in London doing it in September, which is twice the size of the space here. So, you know, it does vary. And I had a chorus of 300 there.
Wow.
Here, a chorus of 80. So everything's different. So there's never a question of cloning.
Mm-hmm.
This would be my third week of doing Messiah performances. And this week I have two cast members, one of whom did it with me 2 weeks ago and one last week, but they haven't done it together for about 3 years. So it's all, it's always different.
Mm-hmm.
And the soloists, for example, bring their own things to it. They say, no, I'd like to do this aria a little slower, a little faster. I'd like to bring this out in it. There's opportunities, of course, for cadenzas and stuff that I don't interfere too much in. They do what they want to do, and that's great. It's very easy to keep it fresh. Plus, you know, it's a masterpiece. It's not as if I'm having to do a piece of junk over and over again. And, I mean, the sort of person you really should be asking questions of for something like that is the person who has to sing Cats 200 times a year. I get to do Handel's Messiah 10 times a year. That's nothing.
Well, you know, that is a very good question, though, because it really, it is so familiar and so beloved. And you know, people have their favorite recording or recordings of this work. And it is a work of genius. And so, you know, you have to bring something that is so special to the table that it will help them forget about that favorite recording. It's a different experience in a live performance.
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing like the collective experience of an audience, in Messiah, practically a congregation. Although, let me say that it is Handel always, or nearly always, performed this in theatres. In secular spaces. So to hear it in an opera house is exactly how he intended it to be done. He did it at Covent Garden Theatre and in the Music Hall in Dublin. He only once or twice, well, one series of concerts he did every year in a chapel in the orphanage in London. But all these oratorios are not meant for cathedrals.
Mm-hmm.
They may be sacred oratorios, but they're not done in sacred spaces. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is very important to me is to get the words across. that's not out of religious zeal in any way. It's just that that's why Handel wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote it to get the message across. And it's a pretty non-sectarian Christian message. It's religion without the Christianity, without the tricky bits.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get into transubstantiation or any of those things where Protestants and Lutherans and Catholics all have difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sort of basic stuff.
Mm.
And the words are extremely beautiful. It's a lovely mixture of the King James Bible and the Book of Common Prayer, which is sort of Shakespearean English at its finest.
Mm-hmm.
Beautifully put together by Charles Jennens, so that the flow of it is very nice. And Handel's music, of course, is just the tops. And for me, that's the great treat, too.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you something sort of beyond just Messiah, but what is it about Handel's music that is so enduring? What really do you think is at the heart of Handel's genius?
Well, I think part of it is he really had a very big heart. And obviously, in the operas, for example, the ladies, particularly the ladies, are fascinating characters, be they Cleopatra, who's a bit of a sex kitten, it must be said, or some of his tragic heroines, even a saint like Theodora. Marvellous, marvellous portrayals of real people. The fact that some of them are monarchs and some of them are saints, they're still very human portrayals for all of that. He, of course, could write glorious tunes. And he had a grandeur in his manner, which you find, I was thinking in painting, of someone like Rubens, who could paint a fantastic ceiling, at the same time could paint a portrait of a very moving portrait of a young girl or of his wife. So he had the grand manner and the intimate human scale. And he's one of the first European composers in the sense that he's trained in Germany, he got his polish in Italy, and then he had that sort of English stuff as well, the sort of personal tradition. So he's writing in a sort of pan-European style, a little bit of France in there because everyone did. But it's all there, and there's something for everybody in there, with beautiful tunes, grand choruses, and there's plenty of it.
Now, other than Messiah, because you are so well-versed in this repertory, I'm curious to know, do you have another favorite Handel work?
Oh, that's very hard to say. There are 40 operas, so it's a little hard to choose. I've done 23 of them, which sounds like a lot, but it's only just over half, in fact. And I've done most of the oratorios by now. I would say the oratorio L'Allegro is one of my favourites, partly because it's tremendous fun to conduct, and also because my pal Mark Morris does a wonderful choreography of it, which I get to watch while I conduct it. And of the operas, it's very hard to say. I like them all, really. Orlando, probably, but that's just because it's one I've done a lot, and I'm a bit of a sucker for magic operas. Heroes and heroines are all very well, but they do sometimes take themselves a bit seriously. They're like politicians in that regard. At least politicians don't sing. And so it's a wonderful piece. I have to say, it's great fun to conduct the fireworks music, but that's because it's really loud.
Isn't that why the king loved it so much?
I think it is, yes. And it's great to do it with fireworks, too, because it gives you something to watch. But it's always great. It's all great fun. And, of course, this is a Handel year. He died 250 years ago in 2009. So we're just coming to the end of that anniversary year. It doesn't mean that any less Handel will be performed, I'm happy to say. But certainly say the BBC did all his operas this year. Every single, all 40 of them, which is amazing.
It is amazing.
And had a very large audience too. So one of the things that I'm really thrilled at in my lifetime is that, because I turn, believe it or not, I find it hard to believe that I turn 60 next month, but that when I was born, Handel was an exotic composer and Messiah was the only thing that was performed. Hardly any of his operas were staged in the United Kingdom. And now every single one of his operas has been staged in the United Kingdom. And a lot of them are in the regular opera houses. A lot of them have been recorded. You hear Handel on the radio all the time. It's an enormous change. So he's gone from being a one-work composer to mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And that just makes me so happy. I'm sure he's happy, and if he got the royalties, he'd be even happier.
So I do want to go back to Messiah, because there is that very famous tradition of people standing during the Hallelujah chorus. And there are all kinds of stories about what is the reason for that and where that came from. And so I thought I would ask you, what is the real story?
I have absolutely no idea. I think certainly all the stories about King George having gout or hemorrhoids just needing to stand up is certainly possible. Certainly when you get to the words King of Kings, you might have thought it was about him. The Hanoverian monarchs loved Handel's music, and I think they were, since in the Hallelujah chorus it's about the Almighty, the King, who was only a king, not a king of kings, might have thought that he was a good idea to stand for the big boss. And of course, when a king stands, everyone stands.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, it's a tradition which I find quite quaint in America as a place that got rid of its king. But it's fine. The main thing I have is that people stand up all the way through it. So you get, if the chairs creak, you hear it. You hear an awful lot of noise during it.
Perhaps you should give a cue.
I think I might. We'll see. It's a fine tradition. And I think it's one of those things. Certainly Messiah is a very good piece to bring a young audience to, especially if they're not used to going to concerts and having that mass experience. That the one I did this summer with 6,000 people in the audience all standing up at that moment was quite something, I can tell you. Because some of them had to stand all the way through because it was a promenade concert.
Mm. But
it was a very uplifting experience.
Huh. Well, you actually gave me a great segue into another question. Sunday Baroque, although we feature old music, we are in the high-tech world, and we have a Facebook page. So I asked some Sunday Baroque listeners if they had questions for you. And one of them was from a listener named Robert Tobin, and he wanted your opinion on what he and fellow Baroque music fans can do to get more young people interested and passionate about Baroque music.
Well, first of all, I think one thing is something you're already doing, which is it's already on the radio, which is great. Another thing I think is that there's an awful lot of, you know, it's getting harder and harder to find a record shop, for example, but it's getting easier and easier to listen to the radio, not just your station here, but the BBC, Deutsche Welle in Germany. It's all available. You know, you could listen to BBC Radio 3 on the South Pole, probably. All the promenade concerts in London are up for a week after they're given. So if you, my general feeling is that anybody under 16 knows much more about the internet than I ever will, that it is all out there. But again, that's really no substitute for a live performance. And that is not really a question I can answer because I don't know exactly how much goes on here, but very often a lot happens that's perhaps like slightly less official than the symphony and the opera. Look out for what's happening at the local university. There are very often early music societies in towns, and they will have websites, and you can go to some church and hear a glorious performance of Purcell or Handel or Monteverdi. And often in a much more informal setting. So check out those sort of things. I'm sure you on your radio station have a sort of calendar that announces concerts that are happening around the listening area.
Oh, sure. Oh,
yeah, because that's another thing to listen to, is don't feel that all the music is happening only in the largest venues. Check out those, that small venue where somebody's doing something a little off the wall, 17th century Italian lute music or something, because that's where you'll hear often the early music. It's not in the grand opera houses or whatever. Mm. Of course, it's great that more and more symphony orchestras and opera companies are doing Baroque music,
mm-hmm.
and that's terrific. But check out the slightly oddball places, and also check out the web for, as I say, things like Radio 3 in London. It's a little churlish of me to advertise another radio station, but as I say, they did all 40 of Handel's operas,
yeah.
and you can tune in for free, mm. and you can find out on the web when they're being broadcast, and listen to them, and they keep them up. So that people in the States can listen to them not at 4 in the morning because of the time difference. But, you know, if you want to hear Handel's Lotario, which was something which is very hard to get, and I've only heard it once in my life, it was broadcast.
Wow.
So you can sort of collect all this stuff
by
being adventurous with the stuff that young people are really good at, which is the web and computery things.
Now, you mentioned that this is your first time in Cincinnati. So how is it that you managed to connect with the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra? You know, you mentioned that also that more symphonies are bringing in Baroque music into their program. So
well, I feel very lucky to have been asked. My only personal contact with Cincinnati is with Evans Miragis at the opera, whom I've known for years. I first met him in Boston when he was working as an administrator of the Boston Symphony, and I came there to conduct, I think, in about 92. So that's about 18 years ago, nearly. And so I'm thrilled to be invited to the symphony. The hall is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wanted to come here because I'm a great reader of Victorian novels, and Anthony Trollope, the 19th century novelist's mother, ran a store in Cincinnati for a couple of years when she was very fed up with her husband.
Huh.
And she actually came by boat from New Orleans all the way to Cincinnati. And Edmund White has actually written a book about her, about Fanny Trollope. And Mrs. Trollope also wrote a book which didn't go down terribly well in America, called The Manners and Customs of the Americans. but she had a soft spot for Cincinnati, and so I've always wanted to come. And I have another reason for coming is that I'm very passionate about art. And on Friday, I'm going to the Art Museum to look at one of my favorite Gainsborough paintings that I've actually never seen except in books.
Oh, what is it?
It's a portrait of a musician called Mrs. Ford, Anne Ford, playing the guitar. And I'm going to get up close and personal with her. Can't wait.
Lovely.
And have a look at that. And the curators of the museum have been very kind to let me have a look at her. So I'm absolutely thrilled. That's one of the things I do when I'm on tour like this, is go to the art museums. And America has more terrific regional art museums than anywhere on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know, I say, oh, I'm going to Kansas City this week, must go to the Nelson Atkins or whatever. It's not just the music. And then was very kind to give me a great restaurant recommendations, and I've got a little list. I've been rehearsing every evening up to now, but the gourmandizing part of it, the really experiencing the town. And I'm very lucky staying in the Hilton Hotel, which it must be one of the most beautiful Art Deco buildings in the country. And I love Art Deco, so I'm just sitting there looking at the ceiling all the time. It's so beautiful. And so I'm having a very good time.
Excellent.
And of course, all musicians come to places and realize that all our clothes are wrong. So we try to be very good for the local economy.
It's very cold here too.
That bit I coped with. There's always, you know, if there's a big shopping mall right by the hotel, somehow we just can't stay out.
So I have another question. This is from another listener, and it's a little bit broader about music in general, but his name is John Zimmerman, and he is in Vancouver, BC, and he says that he wonders when he hears people say, and I guess by people he means radio announcers, you know, that is the only thus and such, you know, say concerto, whatever, of a particular composer. And he questions, how do we know that? He says, if only a fraction of Bach's or Handel's or Vivaldi's music or whatever composer, if only a portion of those works survived or are known, how do we know about the complete works of composers, you know, because they lived so long ago? Aren't we still learning more?
Certainly, we're still finding more music occasionally. A good example would be sometimes pieces appear out of nowhere. That's very rare. Very often a piece is there, but we know, for example, with the Haydn C major cello concerto, we know that he wrote it because there's a catalogue that the composer himself made, which lists the first couple of bars of every piece that he remembered as having written. And we can tell from that which ones have not survived. And in the case of this cello concerto, it says, I've written this concerto in C for the cello and nobody could find it.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime in the 1960s in a castle in Czechoslovakia, when there was a Czechoslovakia, they found it. So it wasn't that it wasn't known, it was that they thought it no longer existed.
Mm.
There are pieces like the Handel Gloria, which was rediscovered in about 2001. A couple of people knew that it existed, but they weren't sure it was Handel. And somebody really took a close look at it and its provenance. Like, it's a bit like identifying a painting. It may have a signature, but the signature might be fake. You've got the piece, but you're not sure whether it's genuine or not. And a source came to light, which sort of made one a little bit more sure that particular piece perhaps was genuine. You can never say it's the only something. There's always the chance that, say, Monteverdi's opera Arianna might show up. We've got the libretto. We don't have the music except for one piece. It would be wonderful in some Venetian library if it suddenly showed up. A lot of music went AWOL during the war, Second World War. 50 keyboard concertos by Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach showed up in Kiev. It wasn't that they were lost. They were lost because they were stolen, in fact, out of a Berlin library. And of them, some were known, some noted, because nobody really cared about C.P. Bach back in the 20s and 30s. They had a catalogue of them, but they hadn't really made a new edition or copied them out. So they'd sort of disappeared. But some of those things are a little bit like when you hear there's been a robbery in an art museum. You think that people are not actually going to throw them away. They've just gone somewhere. This happens to composers' manuscripts. A lot of manuscripts were stolen out of Berlin after the war, largely to keep them out of the hands of the Russians. And an interesting thing is in the 70s, when I was at university, we managed to get a microfilm of a sketchbook of the Eroica Symphony, which had been lost. Now, it's hard to get a microfilm something that doesn't exist. But somebody asked somebody in Poland, and indeed that's where it was, but it wasn't there officially. And when the wall came down, suddenly there it was. Same happened to part of the score of The Marriage of Figaro. So there's a little international politics involved in all of this. Yes, things are being found from time to time. And it's very much like the art world. Paintings come and go. Paintings are misattributed. Paintings go into somebody's bank vault and you think they've gone. I mean, I think the famous Vermeer that was stolen from the gardener in Boston is somewhere. You don't steal something that valuable to throw it away. Mm-hmm. So it's just that it's currently unavailable. Mm-hmm. And it will appear magically again in 50 years or whatever.
On eBay?
On eBay, probably, yes. So who knows? Certain things like Vivaldi concertos do show up. A new Vivaldi psalm appeared about 3 or 4 years ago. It had the name Galuppi on the front, so nobody really bothered to look at it. And it had been sold with the title Galuppi, who was a more modern composer, and therefore they thought they could get more money for it by putting a more famous name on the front than Vivaldi several years after his death when he was no longer fashionable. But since it quotes other works from Vivaldi and is nothing like anything by Galuppi, they'd simply cheated on the name to make a little extra cash. A lot of people did that the other way round. They would say, oh, I've written these quartets are by Haydn. and they're not, but they thought they could get more money for them if they were. Mm-hmm. So sometimes things are misattributed. Mm-hmm. So one always hopes that things will crop up here and there. When the wall came down, all sorts of things happened. Libraries that had previously been really inaccessible, things started to happen. The internet's very useful too. A lot of libraries are now on computer. And so, for example, there was a very substantial Handel cantata, half of which was in Rome and half of which was in Münster in Germany. Hmm. It got put together again. It's like restoring a Greek pot, and two museums have half of it, but they never thought that if you put them together, they'd fit.
How did they get separated?
Some bishop from Rome became the bishop of Münster, took his library with him. Things happen. No, mm-hmm. And it was baggage. Nobody cared. Mm-hmm. One would always like to think that Bach cantatas will mysteriously reappear, but it seems that the choir boys used to use the manuscripts to wrap their luncheon. So the ones at the top of the pile have disappeared. But on the other hand, we found, what was it, in 1985, they found two violins that belonged to Bach. Mm-hmm. They were walled up in the church. So one can live in hope. You know, they might well find another tomb in the Valley of the Kings. There's nothing to say they won't. So it's always a little dangerous to say this is the only thing. The nearer the music, you know, you can more or less say that the Brahms violin concerto is his only violin concerto. Mm-hmm. Because we've got letters, we've got an awful lot of documentation, we've got opus numbers, and a lot of composers, even Handel, left all his music to the king. So it was catalogued very early on.
Right.
So, you know, occasionally they find things like those Mozart piano pieces that he wrote when he was hardly born, where Daddy had to help out. Those were novelties, but you're not likely to find a new Jupiter Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because Mozart kept a catalogue.
Mm-hmm.
And from when he kept his catalogue, at least the last 5 or 10 years of his life, it's all there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're not likely to find a lost Don Giovanni. It would be lovely, it would be nice to find Love Labour's One, or Cardinio, the lost play of Shakespeare, which he wrote with Fletcher. That would be nice, you know. Libraries burn, so we do lose things. Paintings burn.
Sure.
So,
sure.
But we're so lucky to have what we have. And the great thing now is that with scanning and everything else, libraries, even if they have one source of something, if that library suffers a catastrophic fire like the library did in Weimar a number of years ago, there's no actual music that has lost and gone forever. We've just lost the original,
right,
which is a great and tragic loss. But 100 years ago, that thing would probably not have been copied and we would have lost it.
Mm-hmm.
So we can count our blessings, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a very long answer to the question.
I think it's appropriate. It was a very broad question. I just have one more question for you, also sort of broad, and that is, I know you live in San Francisco, or you live in the Bay Area anyway.
Yeah.
And so you hear radio stations there, classical radio stations. You hear classical stations all across this country and beyond when you travel. Mm-hmm. And we're struggling. We're having a hard time surviving in some cities. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts, observations, advice about how we can stay relevant. I know staying relevant, being relevant, is a huge part of the mission of the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how would you advise us to stay relevant?
It's very difficult. Each city has its own dynamic as far as classical radio is concerned. San Francisco is a very tough sell because it's a rotten commuter town. Basically, it's you're going under bridges. You're on a metro.
Uh-huh.
LA's great because you're in your car. You've got a captive audience for a couple of hours.
Right.
In each direction,
right,
every day. So that's one thing. One of the things that I think is tremendously important, and forgive me if I'm speaking out of turn because I don't know what your recipe is here, is not only to play recorded music. Mm-hmm. But to play, there's an awful lot of satellite feeds from concerts around the world, from your local orchestra and mm-hmm. and opera. And I think to have those, the nearest thing you can get to the live performance is the radio performance, not the beautiful manicured CD. Because the CD, beautiful as they are, is for me a little bit like a butterfly collection. It's all perfect. It looks wonderful. But there's a great big pin in the back of every butterfly. They're dead. Mm-hmm. To hear the sound of the applause, mm-hmm. to get some taste of the atmosphere of the spine tingle factor, which is why people go to the concert in the first place. Mm-hmm. My other thing, which I find... and I won't name the towns, is never underestimate your audience. You know, we're going to play a concerto by Vivaldi. It's really exciting. I found that sometimes they talk down to the audience as if they're all 10 and put ads between the, between the movements of a Vivaldi concerto. But musicians are, generally speaking, the worst people to ask about classical radio because we are very often the last people to listen to it. Mm-hmm. I say that not because I don't think it should be there, but one of the things as a musician is I'm very rarely listening to music as a background mm-hmm. thing. I'm not listening to music in my car. I'm not listening to music while I work because my music is my work. It's a little more than work. But the great thing, and I do love to listen to, is... live concerts, or not live concerts, or recorded concerts that they have. And one of the things that I thought was terrific, I was in St. Louis last week, is that we actually did our Messiah performance on as a webcast as well as a radio thing. And we got an intermission question from Alaska. Oh. And I thought that was fabulous, that somebody way up in Nome or something was... We were trying to keep these people warm. That it wasn't just there's more than a local audience right. now. And that the opportunities for listening to classical radio are, in fact, more exciting than they've ever been because of that possibility. And I think the maximum amount of variety that one can get, the better. And one thing I have to say that's great, and I'm probably not the person who should say this, is live interviews with people. Because... that brings the personal touch in there rather than just, say, playing the CDs, to interview the musicians and the people who are coming through town mm-hmm. because that personalizes what happens. I'd be thrilled if anyone listens to this and says, well, he kept me awake. I will come to his concert. That was amusing or diverting. That's piqued my interest. I would now like to go to the concert because that's a very good mission, because it is a mission mm-hmm. to do this. And as classical music is increasingly cut out of life, I was horrified to see in a paper that it listed in the entertainment section when you Googled it, it said music and classical music as separate entities. It's all music. And that somehow classical music... Oh, no, in the St. Louis paper, classical music is now listed under arts. Music is separate, mm-hmm. and it doesn't mean classical music. It's a great shame. It's all music. And we classical musicians love Aretha Franklin just as much as anybody else. Mm-hmm. And to mm-hmm. sort of parcel some corner of it off into that special area is a bad thing. Another thing which is... I think terrible, and I hope my radio station in San Francisco is not listening to this, is they have ads, which are great because they're on television, which is where you really get an audience. Mm-hmm. But they say, you know, it's all a little bit of that level of, do you lead a stressful life? Come to that haven of peace that is Mozart. And what they're essentially doing is selling classical music as Prozac. And it's not. Classical music, like any music, is supposed to make you laugh, to cry, to feel elated, to engage your emotions. It's not to kind of put you into some catatonic state to stop you shouting at your children. And I find that so incredibly insulting to the art that I love that I just, words fail me. Mm-hmm. You don't want to say, come to Messiah and you'll have a nice time, but you won't be emotionally stretched in any way. Mm-hmm. The whole point of going is to be emotionally stretched, to shout yowza at the end of the Hallelujah chorus, or even Hallelujah is fine. I don't care if you join in, but not to sit there like battery chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's terribly wrong, to sell music or to sell anything like that, any art form, as somehow a dampening of your spirits or your emotions.
Well, that is the last thing that you do with any of your performances.
I hope so.
They are thrilling and they are invigorating, and I can't wait to hear the performance of Messiah. And I know, because you are such a wonderful ambassador for music, not just this music, for music, that people will be inspired when they hear you speaking so passionately about
it. I hope so. It's all about the passion, really.
Yeah.
Because it's the passion, and the passion in Handel's case for this one, for the words, to get that across in the most glorious way. And do please come, because the orchestra and chorus and soloists play and sing beautifully.
Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.